I'm going to read a little something to somebody I respect, Dr. Jane Goodall. She wrote this of the book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. It says, brings a much-needed level of scientific analysis to the Sasquatch or Bigfoot debate. Does Sasquatch exist? There are countless people, especially indigenous people in different parts of America, who claim to have seen such a creature. And in many parts of the world, I meet those who, in a matter-of-fact way, tell me of their encounters with large tailless hominids. I think I have read encounters with some of these as well, in every article and every book about these creatures. And while most scientists are not satisfied with existing evidence, I have an open mind, and that's Dr. Jane Goodall. I respect that comment. I'll be back in a moment with Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum, Dr. John Bindernagel on Coast to Coast AM. How would you rate the media, John Bindernagel? How would you rate the media in this entire episode of The Search for Sasquatch?
Well, this is the real dilemma because, you know, it would be very easy to be very negative towards the way this has been depicted in the media, but one can't really fault the media because they're waiting for some kind of informed scientific comment, which is essentially not forthcoming. You know, I mean, you get it from Jeff, you'll get it from me, and maybe one or two other scientists, and that's it, less than a handful. Instead, you have other scientists just dismissing it. You know, I'm interested in that comment from Jane Goodall that most scientists are not satisfied with existing evidence. Most scientists have not examined the existing evidence. That's what's so upsetting. But anyway, so the media, you know, is just going with this rather, well, obviously the hoax hypothesis is very attractive, very simplistic, very welcome, and they've just kind of gone with that and uncritically. And as I say, I understand that, and I sort of can't fault them, but I mean, I don't think scientists should pick up on that and just go with the media interpretation. But so it's a dilemma. I mean, sometimes, you know, we're getting, I think, better stuff now. The television has been helpful. Programs like this are helpful. Opportunities to present the alternative view, you know, which we happen to think is the correct view of the Sasquatch. But it's very hard to get that out.
Give me a for instance, in the event a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot is found or, you know, I hate to say it, but captured, how would that procedure work to get the word out?
I'm going to let Jeff do that. He might have some ideas.
Okay.
Well, obviously that would be the definitive conclusion, although I would expect that there would still be a tremendous resistance to the notion and you know, a show-me attitude would certainly prevail, much more so than for another more what's perceived as a more orthodox discovery.
Would you have to wheel them out like a King Kong?
Well, if you're talking about a live, I would suspect that a live capture is not in the offing whatsoever. What I anticipate will happen is there will either be some serendipitous event, you know, a hunter, like you said, will unfortunately shoot one, yep. Or there will be a corpse or a bone, inexplicable bone found and brought in, or what we're kind of shooting for now is the collection of a DNA sample, which would at least tip the scales of interest, hopefully, and if not full recognition. There just isn't a precedent for recognizing a new species purely on the basis of a novel DNA sequence that I'm aware of.
Is there an estimate of how many creatures there are in North America?
Well, there have been estimates made, I question the accuracy or the basis of many of those estimates. You know, when someone asks me that, usually what I do is try to depict what we think, and I think John would concur, is the inferred social structure of this animal, which is almost certainly solitary based on the footprint evidence and the pattern of sightings and so forth. And so you probably have dominant males that occupy an extremely large range that overlaps that of a number of females and their offspring. So if you can kind of imagine that, perhaps encompassing 1,000 square miles as a social unit, what in primatology we would refer to as a noyu, and then examine the available habitat and sort of transpose that pattern throughout that habitat and then come up with a ballpark figure, I think, you would be hard-pressed to reach 1,000 individuals maybe in all of the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada.
Well, and no wonder then that they're hard to come by. Well, that's sure, not a lot.
No. I mean, it's literally a moving needle in a haystack.
How about their habitat, Jeffrey? How do they live?
Well, as I just suggested, they would seem to be solitary and would, being an omnivore and a generalist, they probably range over considerable areas throughout the yearly cycle, taking advantage of resources as they become available and where they become available. And the habitat that seems to be the preferred habitat is beginning to appear to me to be what are referred to as temperate rainforests. These are the subalpine zones that are quite moist, dominated at least down here is by Douglas fir forests, and that have understories that usually consists of fruiting shrubs such as blueberries or huckleberries, and that would be the typical habitat, and that's quite extensive actually. I mean, along the Cascade Range and the Coastal Range and the western coastal ranges of the or reaches of the Canadian Rockies. Those habitats are quite extensive. In my neighborhood, in the Rocky Mountains, it's a little bit different. The soils or the habitats are still quite moist on the western slopes, but a lot of that moisture is tied up as a snowpack and then is released throughout the winter as runoff as opposed to regular precipitation. But still, those habitats are extremely productive and for a large omnivore.
Do they dwell in caves at all?
Oh, I'm sure that there are opportunistic uses of caves, but there are, if not more, reports that it would indicate bedding sites that are right out in the open. I mean, out in the open in terms of, in a thicket or in a sheltered area, but without refuge to a cave or to a mine. I mean, in areas where that resource is more available, which really isn't that extensive. I mean, there are some caves in given areas, but extensive limestone outcrops are not really widespread throughout so much of the habitat for these animals. We're talking mostly about volcanic formations and soils and depositions.
Do we get any reports of these creatures traveling in packs or in a group, or are they just all spotted, singularly, running across a road or something like that?
The reports I have usually are solitary individuals, sometimes a female with an infant, sometimes larger groups. I've heard of groups here in BC, four, sometimes larger than that. Can I go back to a previous question you asked, George?
Yes, you may.
It was about what happens when we get a carcass. I just remembered that I had a thought on that because I'm thinking, say it's a roadkill or maybe a hunter actually does pull the trigger on one. Yeah. In any case, here's a carcass, and here's this irrefutable proof, this long-awaited actual bones and hide that people have been waiting for. But people are going to say to the scientific community, didn't you guys see this coming? Where was all the scientific discussion leading up to this, And I think that's kind of what keeps me going here. And I know, like with Jeff, here's a couple of us trying to apprise our colleague of something that is very definitely coming. In a way, you could say we're trying to save their bacon. And for a reward, we're kind of shut out of conferences and publications. And I just think it's kind of a curious situation. And again, it comes back to that thing about scientific resistance. They they just keep resisting this, and it's not going to look good. Anyway, so I just wanted to mention
Are you glad, Dr. John, that you have taken this path, this personal path?
Well, not yet. I'm not. No. it's been quite hard. I mean, there's been a certain amount of exclusion. I mean, my colleagues, sure, they'll talk to me about mountain goats and moose and stuff, but if I mention my Sasquatch research, you know, eyes glaze over, and suddenly they've got to be someplace else. They're embarrassed that I take it so seriously, and it's very unfortunate. Anyway,
well, let me reverse a question then: do you regret that you started studying Bigfoot?
No, well, I hope I'm still around when we finally get acceptance, you know, and not just to say we told you so.
Or justification.
I consider us people like Jeff and I and other investigators. I believe we're doing a service, you know, because, I mean, there are people who are seeing Sasquatches, not on a daily or weekly basis, but from time to time, and fortunately, they get in touch with us. We can say, yeah, that's a good description. What, you know, we talk about what color it was and how it moved and what it was doing, and just talking about it as a normal animal, which in a sense it is, which unfortunately they can't get from very many places. So, but you know, and this has been going on for 100 years. I guess that's what's so kind of frustrating, is that by now we should be out there doing detailed studies, you know, like Jeff's making some comments, and I've made some too. And some of this is, you know, they're based on reports, but it gets a little bit conjectural sometimes. Yet, you know, here we have lots of biologists around and other zoologists who could really do a good job on this, but they just refuse to.
Have you ever seen any reports, let's say from the government, that there was some clandestine operation going down here to investigate these things? Any one of you?
Not me, no.
No, I haven't.
Nothing there.
No.
Well, what's it going to take to get science to do a full-fledged expedition to try to find out if Sasquatch indeed exists?
Well, first, I think you have to consider what would that entail? What does one mean by a full-fledged expedition? It's not like a Jane Goodall who goes and sits on a hillside in the Gombe Stream Reserve and gradually habituates a gregarious, noisy, clamorous band of chimpanzees that are largely restricted to one stream drainage. It's a different proposition altogether. If you talk to people who study, and John, I'm sure can reiterate this, who study rare and elusive wildlife, be they collectors or photographers or wildlife biologists, the most notoriously difficult species to study are those that are solitary, that are nocturnal, that are rare, and that are far-ranging. Well, surprise, that's exactly the description of the behaviors and nature of Sasquatch. So I don't think there is a silver bullet. I don't think, but a first step in that direction would certainly be more extensive, ongoing field studies by people who can be supported long-term, to have a long-term presence in areas where there is historical activity and ongoing reports of incidents that can get at that. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the first step anyway.
Yeah, I have a comment on that my sort of looking into this other similar discoveries. You know, one of them was the cougar in the Canadian province of Manitoba, and this for years people had been seeing cougars there, and the wildlife authority said, no, we're a prairie province here. You know, what would a cougar be doing here? They must be seeing house cats and getting the size wrong or something. Mm-hmm. Well, then finally in 1973, a farmer actually shot a cougar in his yard, and then retrospectively. All those other reports were accepted, you know, but they did an interesting thing. They actually just included in a questionnaire for hunters about mule deer a question about cougars. Anybody seen any cougars? Well, they got all kinds of reports, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, if we could do the same with the Sasquatch, you know, we have the same problem. Here's an animal that's not supposed to be here, not even supposed to exist. You know, questionnaire would start, and you know, all biologists have to do, all these reports that come in, like to the BFRO, if they could be followed up, if someone has seen a Sasquatch, if a good field biologist or a conservation officer went out and looked for tracks and found tracks, we could start moving ahead right there. But there's this refusal. I keep coming back to that, and that's what's so troubling.
It's got to be disappointing. What other people are out there in the field like you two trying to get this done? I know Lauren Coleman, a cryptozoologist, he's very interested in the subject matter. We've had some people on who I don't think were very reputable. I'm not going to give any names, no need to at this point.
Right.
But you probably know who they are.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I would add that deserves a great deal of recognition and is my colleague John Myanzinski, who is a professional wildlife biologist out of Wyoming. And he and I have been collaborating in the field, doing habitat analysis, following up on reports, and attempting to collect further evidence in the field for quite some time now, and several years. So that would be one, but I think John would have to agree there just aren't any.
No, well, you know, this is another interesting thing because, you know, the Sasquatch is very commonly classified as pseudoscience, and some popularizers of science, like Carl Sagan is one, you know, writes wonderful stuff, but said, you know, the problem with pseudoscience is that it's not studied according to the rules of science. Well, no, it isn't, because scientists refuse to study it at all. So it's being studied by amateurs, and as you suggest, some amateurs are very good and very disciplined. Others are much less so, come up with some rather extraordinary claims, and in fact can further discredit the subject. So, again, you know, I don't want to sound too critical of scientific colleagues, but the scientific community has kind of brought this on itself, you know, and it's very, you know, so it's got pushed into this, and once it's classified as pseudoscience, well, then it really is out there, and it's called fringe, and it's you know, just more and more taboo. So,
right.
Anyway,
I had an experience here just recently where I was told that by one of my students, in fact, that a faculty member of my department made the comment that, well, he's just exploring the subject, intending it as a disparaging remark about what I was doing.
Right.
And I thought, where have we come to that exploration is no longer considered a real scientific endeavor? And that just dismayed me.
Would you be surprised if one of these creatures was found and it would be more human-like than ape-like?
I would personally be surprised.
You would?
Just, again, based on the evidence that I have had at my disposal that I have interacted with, I really see nothing that would indicate that. And as I said, it would have to present a human of a very different definition of humanity than is characterized by a lengthy and increasingly well documented paleontological and archaeological record of our own history. It would have to be a human of a very, very different nature than. And so then, why would you use that description that it was more human-like? You know, by that, if you mean that it was more advanced, more intelligent, more sentient than a gorilla or a chimpanzee. Well, again, then you have to explain why doesn't the data point that in that direction now? That's pure speculation at this point, I would have to say.
Yeah, the websites. John, we're going to take this break, okay? Then we'll come right back with you. Dr. John Bindernagel and Dr. Jeffrey Meldrum will talk about the proof, the evidence, in a moment. Might want to pick up the After Dark newsletter by calling 1-888-727-5505 or going online at coasttocoastam.com. This is a newsletter where you get 14 issues for the price of 12. Great stories. We've had some Bigfoot stories in there as well. 1-888-727-5505. Let's start with you first, Dr. Jeffrey. If we can talk now about some of the evidence, the physical evidence. What's out there? What have you seen? What have you accumulated?
Well, my interest, because of my research specialty, has focused on the what is actually the most ubiquitous evidence, which are the footprints. And so I've tried to assemble a large sample in order to get a sense of the consistency and the underlying functional anatomy of the foot that's responsible for these footprints. Excuse me.
Sure.
And that's been, for me, the most compelling, the most intriguing and persuasive body of evidence that from this collection has emerged a very consistent and yet remarkably distinct anatomy of the foot that that bears retention of some of the primitive characteristics of a primate foot, although exhibiting adaptations that are uniquely associated with the habit of walking on two legs or bipedalism. And so that's what really set me back on my heels as I ventured into this more deeply was these aren't just enlarged facsimiles of human feet. These are remarkably consistent and elegantly, appropriately adapted feet of a large bipedal primate that that is well suited to the habitat in which it reportedly resides.
Now, when you say large feet, how big are we talking about compared
well,
to a human?
I think the statistical work of Henner Fehrenbach has concluded that the average of all the reports that he was able to glean numerical data from was 16 and a half inches. As I mentioned when we were talking about differences in size of males and females, there are some instances where you can clearly distinguish between what would presumably be a female and what would be a male based on the relative breadth. Just as in human populations, the male, the human male skeleton is more robust than the female counterparts of the skeleton. Greater breadth, greater robusticity, and so for a given length of foot, a male will typically have a wider foot dimension than will a female of the same foot length. And so likewise, we see that same thing mirrored in the Sasquatch sample of footprints, which there are examples of footprints that are relatively broader than our others. So again, it speaks to a sample from a biological population rather than just a hodgepodge of spurious hoaxes and pranks.
Can you tell by the footprints how the creature stands, how fast the creature could be?
Well, not specifically. I mean, yes to the former and perhaps not so much to the latter. It does not seem to have a foot that is designed, say, for endurance running. It probably would not fare well in a marathon, but would probably be able to eat up mileage with a very powerful walk. And one of the characteristics that seems to distinguish these tracks from a human foot and a foot morphology is they are relatively flat. They lack the hallmark of the human foot, which is the fixed longitudinal arch, the raised inside edge of the human foot. And they preserve in that region of the foot, that midfoot area, a much greater range of flexibility, of rotation, what we refer to as the transverse tarsal joint or the mid-tarsal joint. And that allows this animal to negotiate the broken terrain and steep hillsides that it reportedly inhabits to a much greater degree of efficiency than say, would a human, which is really human feet are adapted for flat, open terrain where endurance running and walking are the most advantageous adaptations. We just aren't really built or designed for climbing up and down steep hillsides. I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of training and modification of our behavior, but as far as physiology and functional morphology for long distance running, we probably outstrip most mammals in that regard.
Why doesn't this creature walk on its knuckles like a chimpanzee would, or in some cases even an ape?
Well, I think it's because of the commitment to an upright posture, which has permitted it. I mean, it would be probably many of the same types of selective pressures that produced bipedalism in the African hominids during the Pleistocene. I suspect that some of those same ecological and selective pressures that were creating or selecting bipedalism in Africa were also acting on the primate population, specifically the ape population in Eastern Asia, namely Gigantopithecus. When, as an ape, when the size of Gigantopithecus is attained, it is constrained to moving about on the ground. And once you're an ape and you're on the ground, there's essentially two ways to move. You either locomote on all fours, and knuckle walking would be one option, or you walk on two limbs. And given the particulars of the upper extremity of great apes and long limb length and reorganization of the shoulder from a history of suspensory types of movements with arms above our heads and hanging, suspending our weight beneath our arms, the shoulders are not really well adapted to walking on all fours. And that's why chimps and gorillas, who are quadrupeds of a sort, mm-hmm. walk in a very different way. And knuckle walking is a very modified, very specialized form of walking on all fours or quadrupedalism. Very different than, you know, the way a dog, a cat, or a horse would walk on all fours.
Would you be surprised if one was found?
If a Sasquatch was found?
Or captured?
Well, no. At this point, I wouldn't be surprised at all.
You expect it.
I expect it. I mean, it's, you know, I always shy away from the question, do you believe in the existence of these animals? And because belief doesn't play into it. But quite frankly, I've clearly reached a point where it seems more incredible to me that all of this evidence is to be simply dismissed so offhandedly as so many spurious hoaxes and misidentifications and delusions than I am by the prospect of at least entertaining the notion that a large primate does indeed exist.
John, how far back does this creature exist? What kind of myths and legends have we
heard? Well, that's what's so interesting. I mean, if we just go with the published historical reports, this is now following the Aboriginal stuff, I think 18, you know, there's someone named Scott McLean, a very, very keen investigator who's done an excellent job of digging out some of these historical reports. Very good report from 1839 from Minnesota, and followed by some other good reports from the mid to late 1800s, 1870, back in there. And these are detailed reports, complete descriptions, and that's what interests me so much, that we have had these descriptions for so long. Yeah, as far as myths, see, when we have the problem with the Aboriginal material from First Americans and First Nations people in Canada here is that, you know, soon as something is presented in the context of myth, or if it's maybe it's an image carved on a totem pole or a mask, you know, we think supernatural, and we've gotten this from the cultural anthropologists. And Jeff and I have a colleague who unfortunately died just this past year, Richard Greenwell, and he said, you know, it was a mistake, you know, to go to cultural anthropologists in the beginning with questions about the Sasquatch, because obviously they're going to answer it or address it according to their background. So they talk about, this giant creature is a metaphor for fear and starvation, and, you know, which may be to some extent, but as soon as we have tracks, we're talking about a real animal, a corporeal animal, an animal with a body, not an incorporeal animal, not an animal that's a hallucination or paranormal or that, you know. So that should have changed, but it hasn't. And, you know, and I don't want to keep coming back to this kind of scientific resistance, but, you know, if at some point zoologists could have stepped in and said, oh, well, if there's tracks, we should be looking beyond, you know, myth in the narrow sense of supernatural. we'd be further ahead. But you know, that, as we're saying, that really hasn't happened. But no, that's what's so interesting is that we've got great eyewitness descriptions going all the way back to, you know, the mid 1800s, and the first casts were being tracked back in the 1950s. So we've got, you know, and that's what, of course, Jeff's big contribution to having archived a collection of those casts.
Right.
So anyway, yeah.
You know, and I'd add to that, we, as far as the cultural interpretation or the cultural, you know, overtones placed on a biological or zoological species, a great example is the perception by Western civilization of the gorilla. I mean, it starts off as this this caricature of humanity, which has attached to it all sorts of religious underpinnings and overtones, and then it becomes the bestial embodiment of all the baser instincts of humanity, and then it's the ferocious wild man that the great white hunter pursues and inflates with an air pump, and when it's hoisted up, shot and hoisted up in a tree to have a trophy photograph taken, and then it becomes the, you know, the imperiled endangered species. And then it becomes the gentle giant, the noble gentle giant that is sort of our last link with the shrinking rainforests. Each of those doesn't undermine the fact that the gorilla exists, but yet our interpretation, our own cultural interpretation, even with the species right there proximate, changes as our understanding changes and grows. So it doesn't surprise me at all that a species that isn't recognized still has all these cultural overtones and underpinnings, and that, in fact, different Native American cultures and different Anglo populations that have come into contact have interpreted the experiences in various ways and attached different significances and different meanings to the experiences.
When people go out in search of Bigfoot, you know, you have various groups that go out and they have their cameras and things like that. Do they come back with any evidence at all, John?
Yes, it's getting better. You know, I mean, you know, this dilemma of, you know, the actual qualified biologists and people not studying it, so it's fallen to dedicated amateurs. And I think they're, you know, it's disappointing sometimes because they're not trained, and often they don't realize the importance of certain evidence.
Sure.
But it's improving. They're improving. And, casting tracks, taking photographs. Jeff might have a comment on that, too. I don't know.
Well, I'd agree. I mean, I think we see individuals that, and I'm in contact with a number of individuals that I'm almost, I am very hesitant to refer to them as amateurs. They're non-academics. And they're doing this through their own means and through their own determination. But many of these people are extremely observant. They're extremely experienced in the outdoors. They bring varieties of skills to bear. Many of them are experienced or professional naturalists, wildlife biologists, park rangers, and yes, I think that sort of grassroots effort is what we're working with at this point, and it increases the number of eyes and ears that are out there to document and investigate and corroborate with evidence their experiences.
Does this tell you though that these creatures are hiding from mankind? The fact that they're always tucked away somewhere?
Well, I think in a sense that there's a naturalistic, elusive behavior, but there's also just as many reports I would venture to offer that suggest that there are also individuals, perhaps, that are quite curious about which one would expect, given a great ape level of intelligence. They're very curious about humans and humans' contrivances. I mean, a typical report is a remote cabin that's lit up at night, and someone goes out to the side door to get some firewood, and there's a tall, hairy figure peering in the picture window, the illuminated picture window, wondering, you know, what's going on. I had to chuckle when the organizer of a conference, Jason Valenti, had a T-shirt that said, "Who's watching whom?" Basically, it's which one of us is really doing the observation.
Would a gorilla act that way? Would a gorilla look through a window?
Oh, certainly. I mean, gorillas in zoos are oftentimes entertained, for want of better facilities, by placing a television set in their enclosure, and they have their favorite programs, and so they're quite capable of interacting with that type of a medium. So I wouldn't be surprised at all under similar circumstances, if gorillas were attracted to human activity or the sights, sounds, or even smells associated with human activity, unless they have had experiences that would otherwise dissuade them, be a gorilla or be a Sasquatch.
Have either one of you heard of this old fable or story where an individual in Minnesota claims that he had a Bigfoot in a block of ice, and then he took it on tour, and I guess the ice melted, and so away went the Bigfoot. Did you ever hear that one?
John, you want to take that?
Yeah, I don't know much about it, though. You may know more than I do.
Well, that's the Minnesota Iceman story. And
right.
Again, it's one of those unfortunate situations where it remains an intriguing mystery. And the stories about the origin of the specimen, which gained considerable notoriety, not only because of its public exhibition, but because of the fact it was examined by two professional zoologists, Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans. Bernard was quite convinced of the reality of the specimen. Sanderson, I take, was a little more reticent in his conclusions. But, right, the stories, varied, that it was shot in Minnesota, or there were other stories that it was actually shot in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and shipped out of Vietnam. And the unfortunate thing is, and I have not looked too far into that personally, simply because we don't have a specimen. And so it's of historical interest kind of falls under that category of cultural interest, but I don't anticipate that it will yield any verifiable evidence one way or the other at this point.
Do these creatures seem to show any types of violence toward humans?
There's lots of interesting intimidation behavior, and I wouldn't describe it as violence. It could be described as aggression, and the throwing is an interesting one. A lot of throwing of projectiles, rocks, chunks of wood, chunks of moss,
whatever they can find, I guess.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. What's at hand? Branch breaking, and this really interests me because it's very similar to a chimpanzee and gorilla intimidation behavior. And basically, it's if someone is too close to a Sasquatch and it's feeling discomfort or stress because of that, it wants the human intruder to leave, and it does so. There could be chest beating, loud vocalizations, the projectile throwing, mm-hmm. branch breaking, loud branch breaking, and it just meant to make people leave, and it usually works. And then, we just had a very recent report here on Vancouver Island just this summer in August, where a family fishing in a remote area was essentially chased out. The Sasquatch was near their tent throwing rocks into the river, and it was enough to really spook them and make them leave. And I think it's and that's what's so interesting. This is not like when you have a grizzly bear that's feeling threatened, people are too close to its kill or to its cubs, and there's a human mauling, and a conservation officer is called out to dispatch the grizzly. We have never heard of that for a Sasquatch.
No.
Sasquatches never—they don't seem to go that far. Beyond the stone throwing and that, there could be sometimes the odd reports of chasing.
Okay, we'll be right back, Jeffrey and John. We'll be right back. We're at the top of the hour. We'll open up the phone lines next.